Good afternoon. Welcome to We the People. This would be We the People really, 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 really running today. I know.
I'm here, though.
You made it just the last second.
I did.
Oh, my gosh. So, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff with a big echo. What's going on there, Bob?
Bill.
Yeah.
I don't hear any echo. You sound fine to me.
Oh, uh-oh. It's just you.
It's an inner ear problem.
Yes. Huh. And, of course, Bob Martin is here.
Yes, I'm Bob Martin.
And that way we'll have really fun music and everything. And we're going to need fun music because it's not a particularly fun topic, although it is educational.
Good.
And this education is provided by...
Oh,
you like that segue?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Our sponsor this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. And right now, you can give them a call at 226-9226. They're running their spring service special. So if you've got a tractor, a lawn tractor or small compact tractor, and you want to bring it in and get it serviced, they've got labor specials going on right now. Save you some money. 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Team Power, 226-9226. Give them a call.
They're going to call you, though, right?
Well, yeah, they could call me. They might be lucky enough to get me. You never know.
226, what is it? 9226?
9226.
Simple Simon.
Yeah.
All righty. So, let's see. You can find a ton of information at wethepeopleradio.us. That would be our website with archives going back to, 2010. And Robert Exter, big thanks to him. He always cuts out the celebrations of capitalism. And so you have commercial-free listening.
Commercial-free.
Free of charge. I guess a lot of websites charge for that.
Oh, really?
I was going to listen to somebody else's program the other day, and it's like, well, you have to subscribe for $10 a month or something like that. Bummer.
Yeah.
So anyway, archives are our archives, sure, easy for me to say,
easy for you.
Are free of charge.
Free.
But we would love your sponsorship, and there is a tab on the page if you would like to jump in and kick in whatever you'd like, because the show is paid for by... us and Team Power and a variety of listeners. So feel free to join in. Oh, good. We have him on. All right. So our guest today has been on with us before, but not since. I had to do a little homework on that last night. We haven't talked to William since April of last year. And we were just kind of doing a Canadian's view of what was going on in the U.S. because things must have been nutty last April, although they just released the big memo.
Oh, my gosh.
On FISA-gate or whatever we're calling it these days.
The memo.
The memo. Bill read it this morning. He was so freaked out.
Oh, my gosh. Unbelievable.
So, yeah. We'll have to... the whole world's doing programs on the memo.
Is that all you got?
Huh?
Is that all you got?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, really.
Bring it on.
We're not going to deny
bring
it.
The
we're
memo.
Come out with our own memo.
That's right. It's not a lie. There's nothing wrong with it, but we're going to dispute it anyway because it makes us look bad.
Yeah. Oh, real bad.
Ding. So anyway, if you have
but all the while we're denying that it makes us look bad.
Yes, and we're denying that any of those things are true, although we can't factually refute any of them.
Looks bad to you.
Problem. So if you don't know what memo we're talking about, I don't know how that could happen, but this would be the 3-page and a paragraph memo that came from the from Devin Nunes, the House intelligence guy.
Who's been working on
whether or not, they started looking into this Russia thing, and suddenly, magically, it turned out that it was the DNC and the Clinton campaign that were actually spying on the Trump campaign. I mean, I think we learned at Watergate you couldn't do things like that, and this is obviously much larger than that. So I'll link the PDF to our page for today in case you haven't found it yet. It hasn't wormed its way into your consciousness. In case you didn't get the memo. Nice, Bob. I was crying to be said. So anyway.
Someone had to.
Somebody has to say it. So you will have the memo if you didn't have the memo. And honestly, it's a fast read. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to sort it out. And once you start looking at who the players are and what they did, it's like, we've got a problem. Mm-hmm. So nice that it was made public. So, on that happy note, we're going to join our guest, William Kay. He is in Alberta, Canada, unless he moved since the last time we chatted with him.
I am still in Alberta. enjoying the wonderful weather.
Yeah, it's like 70-something here. I don't know what the heck's going on.
It's supposed to hit 80 degrees today, February.
Some sort of global warming flash going on here. But
We certainly don't have that here. It's 20 below Celsius, which is about 5 below Fahrenheit.
Oops.
And that's warm. It's been colder than that all week.
Oh.
And these are the daytime highs. These aren't the lows. These are the highs.
Oh, and we're wearing short sleeve shirts and sweating, so sorry about that. Actually, I'd like something in between. I'm a big fan of winter. I don't know. It'll come back, I'm sure. So you work on all sorts of stuff. Your website, first of all, and it's linked on our page, but is ecofascism.com. And so I don't know how we originally got connected with you. Just the fact that environmentalism is fascism was catchy and made me want to read more.
Yeah.
Made me want to chat with you back in 2011, I guess. And so it's led you recently into the topic of population control.
Yeah. Actually, the two social movements are almost inseparably conjoined. I've been meaning to do more writing about population control for over 20 years now, and I keep getting sidetracked into other issues. So I set aside a few months and read five more books on the topic and then sort of researched and fact-checked those books. But it was an interesting education for myself. It sort of brought myself up to speed. The initial posting that I just did ran as about 25,000 words. There's 17 articles there. And I didn't even get, I got as far as the 1990s. I thought if I have to go all the way to the modern day with this, it's going to be another 25,000 words. So I'm working on a part two, another posting, to deal with that. One of the humorous things about it is I really was motivated to get into it because there's so much, you know, gay agenda and transgenderism in the mass media and in popular culture right now. And I'm someone who's quite firmly of the opinion that that is a subsidiary movement or an auxiliary movement of the population control movement. And I really wanted to expose that. Never got around to it. Never made a keystroke on that topic. That'll have to wait. First, I wanted to establish that this movement is of a sufficient scale and awareness that it can actually pull off something that size. I wanted to establish that first, and that alone took months of reading and writing to get that far. But that's where I'm at right now. So I'm working on part two right now.
Well, you did a really, really good, I think it's like a 26-minute video, The History of the Population Control Movement, and we've posted that on our page. And I'm sure it's also linked on yours as well. But that was really an eye-opener for somebody who, you know, if
you thought it was like a modern day movement, I mean, this is
or you thought it was just BS.
Yeah.
You know, all population control, right? Like, who's going to do that?
It's been in full swing for a long time.
Yeah, I think this will smarten you up. And, you know, really, when you do talk to hardcore environmentalists, you know, the guys that just eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff, it always does go back to population. They're very open about it. There are just too many people. The people are, you know, causing the global warming. People are causing too much use of resources. And then you get into the who should be here and who shouldn't. I mean, it's a pretty quick trip.
There's a profound division within the environmental movement. If you would stop the calendar, say, around 1970, early 1970s, the entire environmental movement was universally supporting the population control movement. They were all believers in overpopulation. It was very much part of the same hysteria that went around in the early 1970s when that movement took on the name environmentalism. Over the next couple of decades, because issues like abortion and immigration are so dicey and so controversial, a large section of the environmental movement stopped talking about population. And so now you've got groups that still have population in their names. If you look at the environmental movement's propaganda, their websites, they all make some mention of it. If you look at the population control organizations, they all make a lot of mention about the environmental impact. But you know, the recent example, there's a group called Scientists and Environmentalists for Population Stabilization, classic population control activist group. They were denied a booth at a recent environmental conference. There were other environmental groups that did not even want them in the building.
Yeah,
so there is this division within the movement. They all tend to support it, but some of them have come to the view that this is bad PR. like the Sierra Club does not want to be associated with anti-immigration activism, abortion, things like that.
Right, and so the mention of population control is kind of taboo within their movement, within their public
but
image.
But they really do think that.
Yeah, but that is a big. Yeah, big part of it.
Universally.
So let's take a really quick break here, and when we come back, you can start us off wherever you'd like, because
I have a plan.
Okay, yeah. I'd really like people to hear your research, because it makes perfect sense. We will be right back. Our guest is William Kay. And now we're going to be talking about the history of population control. I think you'll like it, I guess I could say that. You can find everything at wethepeopleradio.us.
But good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Too many people, and not enough eyes to see. Too many lives to lead, and not enough time. Lost the sun. She's come undone.
Too many people.
Too many people.
Yeah. They're eating all the food.
So, of course, we always have a group that's going to decide who the too many are.
Yeah, we're like
a Canadian group there, I'll have you know, the Guess Who.
Oh, it was? Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, see, it's good you're here to educate
Winnipeg,
us.
Winnipeg, Manitoba.
You go, baby.
Go, Winnipeg.
Okay.
All right. Fire the rocket.
Okay. Well, probably the most difficult concept when you talk about population control movement is the word movement. It's difficult to describe exactly what a social movement is. A lot of people have a tendency to describe movements as though they're conspiracies, but they're far larger things than that. They contain, like, a population control movement is a whole armada of politically motivated organizations. It involves thousands of organizations. It's not centrally coordinated. It's thoroughly integrated with the environmental movement, which is, of course, much larger. But there's a key concept in movement politics, and it's called the built constituency. And I will give an analogy, and hopefully I don't go too far out on the limb on this. The environmental movement was one of the driving forces behind global warming, that whole propaganda campaign, climate change. The environmental movement is large. There's probably around the world about 30 to 40,000 organizations that you would define as environmental movement organizations. What we now call the climate industrial complex, you know, all the manufacturers of wind turbines and solar panels and biofuels and that whole industry now, has an estimated annual turnover of about $1.5 trillion. Wow. $1.5 trillion. If you look at all of these environmental organizations, some of them appear very large, like, you know, World Wildlife Fund collectively probably have an annual budget of $500 million, Greenpeace in the hundreds of millions. A lot of these are large organizations. There's a lot of wealthy philanthropic organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, the Pew Trusts. They pour scores of millions of dollars into these movements every year. But whereas it looks like the environmental movement is huge, the thing that they created, the climate industrial complex, is actually 100 times larger than what they have created. And without the changes to the environmental regulations, without the changes to, you know, the laws that made solar power economical, all the subsidies that went into creating wind power, without the changes of the regulatory environment, those industries would not exist. First came a political campaign. Then came an industry. You have the same phenomenon occurs within the population control movement. I prefer to call the population control movement the abortion, sterilization, contraception, medical industrial complex. It took decades, generations of political activism to change the laws regarding these issues, abortion, sterilization, etc. But now what you've got is an actual industry. There's an abortion industry there that did not exist before. It is now, in fact, larger than the political campaigners that created it. So it's like one gear is turning a much larger gear. There's like Planned Parenthood alone has 600 clinics. Like it's sort of a franchise operation. It has over 600 clinics. You know, they've got their receptionists and their janitors. It's a major organization. It has a budget of, you know, over $1 billion a year. That's much larger than, like, say, look at a group like Population Connection. A lot of the groups that are still advocating explicitly for population control. There's 30 or 40 major ones in the United States. The biggest by far would be the Population Council. It has a budget of about $85 million. But most of these other groups are actually quite small affairs, like $1 million, $2 million budget. The thing they created, like a lot of these big pharmaceutical companies that manufacture contraceptive pills, the amazing amount of sterilizations and things like that that go on, that's a multi-billion dollar industry. And those firms and businesses and medical practices that are involved in that, they have their own public relations departments and their own lobbying campaigns. So when we understand these sort of movements, you got to get this idea of like these small politically active gears eventually creating these large built constituencies that sort of feed back on them. These groups now, like a lot of wind power companies, give money to environmental organizations.
Sure.
Because without these regulations, they wouldn't exist. Yeah. So they sort of feed back on one another. What you've got in the United States and Canada, other countries, is this large abortion, contraception, sterilization industry that was created by the political activism of these population control groups.
Yeah.
How's that?
That's a mouthful. But it kind of demonstrates why in so many communities contraception is free. I mean, you can get free condoms, free IUDs, free birth control. You know,
well, and interesting. Every discussion about, you know, medical insurance that they somehow conveniently called health care.
Has to include.
Yeah. It has to include birth control, like somebody's paying a lot for it outside of their medical insurance.
I mean, you know, I encountered that so many times researching this. I'm starting to get deeply suspicious of the whole public health insurance industry. Mm-hmm. You know, the extent to which the population controllers were involved in this. Just keep in mind, let's take a step back a bit. You know, with the abortion campaigns, they really got going in the 1960s. At that time, the upper middle class, with their connections to society doctors, they already had access to safe abortions. The whole political campaign was to make sure that the poor, you know, the blacks, the what have yous, to make sure that they had access. This was an elite group trying to make sure that another group had access to abortion, sterilization, contraception. They were to foist it upon another group. And you look at these public health insurance debates and that, you know, and if you look at it from the angle of the population controllers, it's all about that. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the group they're talking about. They want to make sure they get free access to the pill and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
there was a time when USAID used to fly helicopters over the slums of Manila and throw condoms out the window.
Wow.
He's literally bombing the ghettos with condoms. The idea was just to inundate them, just to saturate these populations with contraception technologies.
Wow. Talk to us.
Go back to the beginning.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the actual sterilization programs that have gone on in the past. And these aren't
things. He researched back to the 1800s.
Right.
And I think most people would say, oh, that's silly. It didn't. It that wasn't happening back then.
Oh, it existed in a clearly articulated form in the late 1700s, for sure. On the issue of sterilization, I date that to some speeches given by Francis Galton in the 1880s. And he was concerned that there were inferior strains of Englishmen, you know, Englishmen that weren't quite up to snuff. And he wanted to start to having mass sterilization programs to limit their breeding.
Mm.
Starting in about the 18, in the American context, from about 1897 to 1907, dozens of U.S. state legislatures passed compulsory sterilization laws. And it wasn't until Indiana in 1907, like until that time, either the governor would veto it or the courts would block it. And in 1907, Indiana passed a compulsory sterilization law. There was a very powerful political organization at the time called the Eugenics Research Office, and they created a model draft sterilization law that they, you know, sent to every legislator in the United States.
And how many
between 1907 and 19? Well, go ahead.
How many people? I mean, you know, I don't think people really have a firm grasp on how many people were affected by these sterilization laws around the world. I mean, they were
the world or in the United States?
Well, both, really. I mean, the United States, I think, came later, but
Indiana's law was the first in the world.
Oh, okay.
Oh, really?
In the United States, it was slightly less than 64,000 people suffered compulsory sterilization over the next 50 years. Now, these were people, like, taken in handcuffs to the surgery, okay? Mm-hmm. At that time, those started to become declared unconstitutional, that sort of practice. However, there was a U.S. federal court judge made a ruling and a finding of fact in 1974, and he estimated that there were up to about 100,000 Americans being sterilized every year upon threat that their welfare was going to be cut off, that their medical aid was going to be cut off. He estimated that the involuntary sterilizations. Now, these people were not being brought in handcuffs or shackles to the surgery room, but they were simply being pressured by doctors unlawfully. The people who were telling these people this information had no authority to cut them off welfare or to kick them off medical insurance programs, but they were successfully threatening them and browbeating them into going through a sterilization program.
So this is obviously
that the federal court considered.
This is obviously targeting the lower income folks. Right.
Always, and it's always racist. In every country, you see it. It's always racist. They're all weird definitions of racism because there's a lot of white versus white racism that used to be very clearly articulated within the eugenics movement, which you don't see too much of anymore. But in Nazi Germany, a 12-year period, 5% of the adult population, and these were Germans, were surgically sterilized.
Wow.
Because,
and quite often it was moral failings, you know. They had this whole thing with IQ tests, and the sterilization courts becoming agitated because so many of the people they declared to be feeble-minded were doing very well in these IQ tests. They sterilized them anyways because, you know, this guy was a ne'er-do-well. He was some troublemaker. He was a whatever, right? So just sterilize them. But that was, you know, a couple of million people in 12 years were sterilized. 5% of the adult population. And these were not the Jews. The Jews got exterminated. These were German citizens.
Wow.
You had even, in terms of like mass sterilization, I would point to 1976 India. They had what was called the Great Population Emergency, just a state of absolute hysteria that they were overpopulated. You know, India's population has grown by a third since then. There was no population crisis. There was no food crisis. But in a single year, 8.2 million people were forcibly sterilized in India. Over 2,000 people were shot dead resisting it. So those sorts of campaigns have been conducted in many countries. What you see now in the United States, there's still a mass sterilization program going on. They've just become a lot more sophisticated. Right now in the U.S., every year about 700,000 women are surgically sterilized. Dropping back a bit, the population control masterminds developed a program in Puerto Rico called the postpartum technique, and where they realized that it was very easy to capture women, to get them to agree to a sterilization operation if you talk to them either just before or just after childbirth. Because at that time, they more or less throw themselves at the mercy of the doctors, you know, whatever you say, doctor, and you can get them to consent to sterilization. They pioneered the program in Puerto Rico, a group called the Population Crisis Committee, which we could talk about later, and they handed the program over to the U.S. Department of Health, and within 10 years, they sterilized one-third of all the women in Puerto Rico, and it was almost entirely through that program. You'd go in to have a baby at a government clinic, and they would just put this, and then they really worked on the sales pitch of, you know, how you pitch it to a woman, you know, to get her to consent to this. Quite often they were on medication too, so it was, you know, voluntary in captions, you know. Right now in the U.S., there's about 700,000 women get sterilized every year. About 55% of them are within 48 hours of delivering birth. They're still using that postpartum technique. 10% of all births in the United States are immediately followed by a sterilization of the woman.
Wow.
A lot of the abortions, like there's a million abortions every year in the United States, they do the same thing. I couldn't get really hard stats on how many women have abortions, sterilizations following abortions. For at least a couple of decades, all the U.S. teaching hospitals, it was a requirement. If you wanted to have an abortion, you had to consent to a sterilization. But I was researching it, and there are so many of these abortion clinics, they advertise, yes, you come in, get your abortion sterilization combo package. I also came across a lot of the obstetrics journals and that, where they clearly promote it. One of the journals made it very clear that the doctor has a positive obligation to try to talk the woman coming in for an abortion to also have a sterilization.
Wow.
So 55% of those sterilizations are women who are immediately post-childbirth. I don't know what the percentage is for women who've just had an abortion. It's also considerably high. And there's some other stuff that goes on. The woman that does my proofreading for me on the website, she went in to have a cyst removed from her uterus when she was in her late 30s. The same thing happened. The doctor shows up at the foot of her bed, just before the surgery, and talked her into a hysterectomy. And I don't know how much of that's going on, but I think there's quite a bit of that going on.
Wow.
So revisiting that 700,000 women sterilized every year in the United States, I'm saying, 80% of them are women who have been sort of pressured or cajoled into a sterilization operation on the eve of some surgery or some major invasive medical process. It's a long ways from voluntary, and it's having a real impact. There's over 10 million women in the United States who have been surgically sterilized. You would find similar sort of ratios across the first world. But this program didn't stop. It became just more sophisticated. And you can bet, if you look at some of these groups like, the Center for Biological Diversity, and that, they've got over a million members. And that's an extreme population control group. And I wonder how many doctors are members of Population Connection. They claim to have 40,000 members.
That'd be crazy
negative
to know.
Population group.
Yeah.
What's that?
That would be pretty crazy to know. I mean,
I'm sure it's in the thousands upon thousands of doctors.
Right.
Absolutely.
And once again, they're highly selective. About who they're targeting for these sorts of things. You get a woman in her late 30s, part of the doctor just can say, well, you're not going to have kids anyways, why don't we just do this? And then he convinced her that it was probably better to, it was easier to do the operation if they did that. It sounded really sleazy, and you wonder if they, and a lot of countries like India and what have you, they had quota systems.
I wonder if it isn't going on today. We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, take us back to the beginning of this research of yours a little bit. Let's set the stage for how we got to where we are now, because I'm always worried that if we start with what's going on now, not having built the foundation,
yeah,
people will dismiss it, and your research is really good.
Somebody
we'll be right back.
Told me a long, long time ago.
Call her name at 7:30. I pace around the parking lot and I walk down thousand gifts that I got. Can't you see? It's not me you're dying for, and she's feeling more alone than she ever had.
Yeah, there's no point in being here. It's not that great.
Consider okay. The alternative.
Yeah, that's how they do it. They do it with music.
Yeah. Everybody's doing it.
Oh, my God.
Well, they do.
So, okay, back in the day, because your first...
Okay.
Well, your very first title in your table of contents...
Malthus.
Malthus.
Yeah.
And so who exactly is that? And what did they do?
Malthus,
big deep.
He trained to be an Anglican church minister, but he made his career as England's first, probably the world's first professor of political economy. His dates are 1766 to 1834. And his launch into fame was a essay, small book that he wrote 1798 called The Principle of Population. And as I point out on the posting, he was a very two-faced sort of guy. You really have to read more of his stuff to see it. On one hand, he's sort of addressing the general reading public, and he's saying, you know, the world's overpopulated. Agriculture will never keep up with the rate which human people are breeding. And with another voice, he's quite clearly talking to the rural elites of England, and he's talking about the laboring classes. You know, they're hired hands, they're sharecroppers, they're sort of, you know, the toiling herd. They are breeding too fast. In 1795, a few years before he wrote his first essay, one of the counties in England, the Berkshire County, passed the Berkshire, it was called the Outdoor Relief Act, something like that. It was basically a welfare policy. They were going to use parish funds, and they were going to subsidize the incomes of the working poor. And a lot of the rural elites, some of the rural elites benefited from this because they had a lot of seasonal laborers, and this was a way to keep those people alive when you didn't really need them on the farm. But generally, across the gentry, and Malthus was born unto the gentry, and these are people who have scores of sort of hired hands and tenant farmers and sharecroppers and what have you, they dreaded this idea of giving them welfare because they thought it would undermine labor discipline and they would just start breeding like rabbits. And that was the big fear then, and it remains that fear. It's sort of, it's the lower working class, it's the working class in general. It isn't so much that the world can't support more and more people. If they thought that the economic system or the property system that they had in place in England could not deal with these rapid population increases. So it would better just to, rather than modify England's property regime, which would require throwing into cultivation a lot of uncultivated land. And he was very clear about that. They didn't want that happening. And he said, if you kept doing that, the gentry would end up just being farmers like everybody else. All the hired hands would run off and get their own farms. And that certainly wasn't, he was very clear that, you know, what you really need is a rural elite that has enough time and leisure to become scholars and artists and then philosophers like him. And throwing open the wilderness to your hired hands isn't going to do it because right. They're going to leave. They're going to go to America.
So
that was not an option. The main option, as he thought, was, you know, finding ways to suppress the fertility rate. And he was absolutely brutal about talking about ways to increase the mortality rate. He was explicitly calling for, you know, situating the lower class areas of the city near marshes and swamps, undermining public health, thwarting popular sanitation programs. They wanted these people to die young. And he was very, very explicit about that, as were his followers. Like the real drive behind the anti-vaccination movements came out of the Malthusian community. Even as late as, you know, John D. Rockefeller III, he created the Population Council in 1952 after he had a bitter break with the Rockefeller Foundation because they, it was sort of a self-perpetuating board of trustees, and he was telling them, you know, your programs of public health and your programs of the, of promoting new agricultural technology are just leading to this population explosion. They're
right.
just sort of causing more problems down the road.
So you control.
So that's been a consistent theme of this movement, you know, from the 1790s up to the present.
So how does that, you know, how does that work with what we're, you know, basically what he was saying was you control the numbers of cheap labor to control the expansion, and we're kind of doing the opposite now, aren't we?
You've got a very conflicted system. And you've got these immigrants coming in while you're suppressing your birth population. What's bizarre is in America, you know, the abortions almost equal the number of immigrants.
Right.
I mean, if it was just a matter of bodies, you could just stop one and the other. You stop them both. The only explanation for that is that you've got, you know, conflicts within the political elites, conflicts within the ruling elites. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a lot of the major employers are pretty much for wide-open immigration. They want the cheap labor coming in. This wasn't always the case. I mean, that was... These tensions really blew up in the 1920s in America when they first passed the Immigration Control Act in 1924. And then there was really this sharp division. Like the railroaders, they wanted as much immigrants as possible. They had built these railway lines on the understanding that they were going to put farmers on either side of them all the way to the Pacific Ocean. But there was always an element, particularly within the U.S. Northeast, of the rentier scholars. These were people who had inherited, you know, significant fortunes, and they had a different mindset. So what you're seeing in America doesn't make any sense. What you're seeing in a lot of these countries, like Canada, doesn't make any sense. On the one hand, you've got this really intense fertility suppression campaign going on that's very successful. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you're welcoming in all these immigrants. That is just because you've got conflicting elites. That's the only explanation I can come up with. And it's pretty verifiable. But you're right, it's a huge contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because they always talk about the immigrant population. Well, who's going to pick the lettuce? Who's going to work in your motels? And it's like, wow. So you really are importing. I mean, there is an effort to import a lower class of
cheap laborers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about that. But that tension is not new. I mean, in the debate that roiled around the 1924 Immigration Act, the American sort of, the elite community was very bitterly divided. There was always an element from the Chamber of Commerce, certainly from the railroaders, a lot of the merchants, what have you. They wanted a lot more immigrants, as does the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today. They're pretty much open borders. And it's interesting because the Democratic Party of the United States is the one that is so pro-abortion, so pro-transgenderism, and so pro-mass contraception and what have you. They're all so open borders. It's just a deep conflict and a deep contradiction within the system. What you will find in the, you know, the official population control movement, you will find a lot of anti-immigrant activism there. And a lot of that, they've attracted a lot of attention of the old-school racist community. And that's what's really, that's why the mainstream environmental movement doesn't want to have anything to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, definitely there's probably a couple of dozen groups that have the word population in their name in the United States that are explicitly, adamantly opposed to any kind of immigration.
Right.
But they obviously do not have the ear of government.
Well,
at this point.
And I think the thing we're seeing really clearly from our, you know, not everyone in the Democratic Party, because obviously everyone doesn't get to speak at once, but the leadership anyway, is that they are much more concerned about what happens with a handful, really, in the scope of all things, a handful of illegal aliens versus their own citizens that they are supposed to be representing.
Those are undocumented Americans, by the
undocumented
way.
The undocumented Americans seem to be taking precedence over the documented Americans. We've got to take one more quick break, and we're going to come back with our guest, William Kay, in case I forgot to say that last time. And he will be with us through the next hour, too, because there's no possible way we're going to get through all of this information. It's really fascinating, and it's something that I think people should be aware of, or they will not see it. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You heard it.
There you go.
You heard it here first.
Population boom.
Yeah. Subliminal 70s.
Well, and he talks about that in his articles, the subliminal 70s. Who is that?
The Stylistics.
Oh, how did I not know that?
Can I put in a request for the DJ? Diana Ross and the Supremes, Love Child.
Oh, very good.
My favorite, Population Control. We'll play that at the next break.
Ah, nice. Okay, so...
Anyways.
All right, so these guys, at the early end of this, right, they were looking at the underclass. These were the people who worked in the factories, and before factories, they worked on the farms. And so they basically were doing all the labor. These were the laborers, and they felt that they were inferior.
Well, when Malthus, he was very clear that he said when he referred to the laboring classes of society, he was referring to the majority of the society, the majority of English population.
But he didn't actually
feel... It wouldn't have just been the lowest of the low. This would have been the broader sort of working mainstream population.
And he didn't actually believe there was a population problem, though.
I probably uncovered a dozen quotes where he talks about the scanty population of the earth. He talks about knowing of countries where you could increase the population by 100-fold.
Okay, so he didn't really think there was a problem, but he pitched it as a way to control.
He was just very two-faced. I mean, he would always put out this the great law that he had uncovered, which was that human population exceeds agricultural output, which was nonsense. Okay, agricultural output is constantly growing faster than the human population. And this was occurring while he was writing this. Europe was undergoing a major agricultural revolution.
Wow.
But he was oblivious to that, and that's just been drilled into people's heads. I mean, I did not, expend a single word debunking the overpopulation myth. To me, it is so obviously false, it is not even worth addressing. And the more you read about the movement, you realize they don't believe in it either. They've got other agendas. I really like that group. I don't like them, but they're so betraying of their own motives. The Center for Biological Diversity, which is a newer group in the United States, which now has over 1 million paying members. But they keep driving home this point that like what they're really into is saving the wildlife, saving the wilderness, what have you. They hand out condoms with polar bears on them, stuff like that. But I Googled population control in their own search database, 524 articles. Wow. And they are militant population hawks.
Mm-hmm.
But they're hitting the nail on the head. If there's a, it's the grow and explode thing. If the population were to, their fear is, the population were to grow to a certain point, a lot of people in the cities are going to start looking at these wilderness areas.
Right.
And saying, why don't we open these up for development? And that, of course, is the great horror, the great dread. You know, you live in a country that's, you know, 50-60% public lands taken out of development, a huge room to expand and open into new frontiers. And I live in a country that's, you know, that times 10.
And
yet there's a perception that there's a shortage of land and
right.
there's too many people. And it's
right.
an utter absurdity.
And they're going to use a little bit of it.
Their fear is someday the American population are really going to have a free and open discussion
right.
about what should we be doing with public land.
Yeah.
And you haven't heard that in your lifetime. I haven't heard it in Canada either. But at some point, that's going to be the main issue of an election. It's not going to be gay marriage. It's going to be, what should we do with these public lands?
Right.
Yeah, and we're not allowed to, you know, drill on them or use them, and the environmentalists all freak out. We're destroying our public land, and
you know, look at the, you know, the forestry industry in California. Look at the coast, the northern coast of California. Its potential to grow.
Yep.
If they would just throw it open for development, it'd be a tremendous boom.
Yeah, we're sitting in a resource-rich environment, obviously, and they won't let go of it. So
talk about the dams.
Yeah. Don't get me started. when we come back, though, we've got to make sure and hit Margaret Sanger and that whole thing, because that's really important for people to know if they don't already. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay. We're talking about population control on Sunday afternoon here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You're joining us on KC&R Shasta Reading.